Hey team, you're about to experience my interview with Jeff Greenfield from Provalytics. Provalytics proves marketing works. It is an attribution and marketing planning platform for a cookieless world. They claim that they can track your marketing and performance across even walled gardens without cookies, without IP tracking, and without any of the other nefarious ways in which some platforms do website user tracking. There's a fascinating conversation. We've had some other analytics platforms on the pod before, but every single one of these platforms seems to do things slightly differently and bring something new to the table. Enjoy the interview. This is the E-Commerce Edge podcast with your host, Jason Greenwood. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the podcast. It is my absolute pleasure to welcome Jeff Greenfield from Provalytics. Welcome, Jeff.
Oh, thank you, Jason. Excited to be here.
I'm super excited to have you along for the ride today, my friend. And look, we connected on LinkedIn, and I saw what you guys are doing over there at Provalytics, and I thought, man, we got to get you on to talk about this amazing platform. You've been the CEO there for nearly 2 years now, haven't you?
Yes, indeed. And it's an exciting time right now in e-commerce, and with everything that's happening in the advertising technology space, it's going to be fascinating to see what the next 2 years looks like.
It certainly is. And you guys bill yourselves as the cookieless attribution and planning platform for all media, even walled gardens without using tags. That sounds like a pretty ambitious goal for a platform.
It does, especially if you're looking at it from the perspective of just being in the digital era. If you're just a digital person and that's all you've known from the advertising space, it sounds like it's absolutely a lot. But the reality is that we're actually moving to a world of, you could say back to the future. We've gone backwards a little bit in order to move forward. And it all has to do with all of the restrictions and all of the changes that we're starting to see that's occurring right now in the advertising world.
You do bring up something very prescient and very, very time appropriate, I think, with all of the major tech vendors talking so heavily about privacy and obviously what's happening with the GDPR in Europe, what's happening with the privacy restrictions in California and other states. This is really becoming a hot topic. I personally don't think that this has anything to do with privacy. I think that all the major tech vendors and platform providers are very happy about these privacy protections because it further entrenches their walled gardens. And in fact, I don't think consumers give a rat's ass about privacy. If any of us gave a rat's ass about privacy, we wouldn't have that glued to our hip 24/7, 365 within a meter of our head at all times. So I think most of these solutions are solutions in search of problems. I think that I forget what the stats are. I saw some stats not that long ago about the cookie acceptance rate and this massive disruption we see in UX where every single website now says you got to accept these cookies. It's something like 98 or 99% of people accept all cookies or something like that. And they accept it within a half a second of the cookie notice showing up on their website. And yet we're massively disrupting UX over something as stupid as cookies. Which has been around since the dawn of time when it comes to the internet. I believe that this whole privacy move is a complete red herring. I don't think consumers care about it. I don't think consumers want it. I don't think these big tech companies that are crying crocodile tears in many respects about these privacy moves. I actually think it benefits them. It further entrenches their monopoly over data across the internet. But if we set all that aside for the moment, my skepticism about that and my cynicism about all of that, the reality is that the world is changing when it comes to privacy, right? It just simply makes it very difficult for brands to understand which of their marketing initiatives are actually making money for them.
You're absolutely right, Jason. And to go back to your point, I saw a meme the other day that talked about how years ago, people would write in their diary, and if someone found it, they would completely freak out. Now people put their diary essentially online, and they get upset if people don't read it. So how we've gone about changing our attitudes towards invasion of privacy is substantial. But the fact remains that there are now regulations, and we see this happen a lot in industries that are initially unregulated. They're going to move as fast forward as they can. And eventually it's going to get to a point where regulation is going to come in and move it back to the middle. And when that point occurs, which is what's happening right now in the world of advertising and ad tech and the internet, large companies say, okay, how can I make these moves and make it to be an advantage for my company where it's not a negative, it actually increases revenue for us? And exactly to your point, this concept of a walled garden. And the last one to become a walled garden essentially is Google was one of the first to have kind of the open internet. They allowed all sorts of ad vendors to add their tags so that they could capture data and do everything to help advertisers from targeting to measurement. And they finally put up the walls under the guise of privacy. But what that does is it makes it very difficult. If you imagine you're a brand and you're advertising, let's say on Amazon, you're on Google, you're on Meta, and you're on Walmart, you can get great information from each of these places in terms of how they're operating. So if you work at this brand and you're in charge of Walmart, you can optimize in that Walmart world, but you will have no idea what is the impact of the brand's TV advertising that is driving people into retail on your Walmart sales. And you also will not know how your Walmart advertising is actually driving people to go to Amazon or driving people to go into retail. So if you are the CMO of this brand, you don't know how everything is talking to each other. And that's the issue. Now, and that issue surpasses all of the cookie issues, because when there's a walled garden, what that means is you cannot get data in and out of there at all. And so as a result, we have to go back to the future. And what I mean by that is, before the world of digital advertising, all we had was TV, radio, print, and direct mail. And there was nothing directly connecting advertising to sales. You would run TV ads, maybe run some billboards too, and people would just show up. And so as a result, you had to use something called math to figure this out. You could not look at things on a deterministic basis. You had to create models and put assumptions into models and then to see how well the models predicted. So there's all these processes for this. Back in the day, it used to be called marketing mix modeling. It was usually a heavy lift, a very big project. And the problem for today's marketer is the output of marketing mix modeling. All it does is it tells you for your channel how much more to either spend or decrease, but it doesn't tell you at a campaign or an ad level what's actually working. And so bringing that forward to today, we need to get that data down to a very granular level. So essentially, Provalytics takes the old world of marketing mix modeling and adds in machine learning and AI, plus the requirements for a modern day marketer so that you can optimize at the same level you're used to optimizing at. And that's essentially what it does. That's how we're able to surpass the walled gardens. We can get past all of the cookie issues and any future privacy issue, because we're not interested in user level data. We only require that daily aggregated data sets, which is great.
And so effectively, if I start to think about how Provalytics works, we can think of it as a predictive modeling engine, right? That's really what we can think of it as, is we're saying, okay, here are the changes that we're making over time to where we're putting our efforts and our spend from both a marketing perspective, organic, you know, from an SEO perspective, from a paid campaign perspective. And here's the channels that we're marketing through. Here's the campaigns that we're running. Here's the traffic that we're driving. And here's how we're getting these results. And we have to look backward to look forward. So we have to look at what's happened, what the performance has been, what the performance has been over time based on what we've spent and where, and what traffic we've driven as a result of that effort. And then we can forecast, or we can model out, in theory, we can then model out, okay, if we make changes to this mix, or if we make changes to these campaigns, if we make changes to where we're putting our effort and our investment, then in theory, we should be able to predict what levers that's going to move and what ultimately that is going to do to our bottom line performance and results in terms of sales.
You're absolutely right, Jason. When you think about the century that we just left, which is this world of multi-touch attribution, where we had to add tags and get all of this granular data, which is all going away because of cookies, the end result of that was to produce a historical record of what just happened. And that's one requirement that marketers have. Marketers have to report. Marketers both have to report, and then they also have to plan. And so in the world of MTA, they would report, and then the way they would plan is they would look at who their winners were, who their losers were, and create a plan based on that in terms of to reorganize the budget, or if their budget was cut, they would cut the ones who were the least performing campaigns. In this instance, since we're borrowing from marketing mix modeling, we can utilize the forecasting capabilities that are in it. And what that means is that we can then go to the machine and we can say, hey, my budget's going to be flat for the next 30 days. I'm willing to risk 50%, meaning you can decrease or increase any of my campaigns by 50%. And I want to focus on this time sales versus orders or revenue, let's say. I need to increase revenue. Give me the best possible plan. So instead of having to analyze the data, you ask the machines to do the work, essentially asking the AI, give me the best possible plan. And then you can look at that plan and either do it exactly or pick and choose what are the changes that you want to make in the plan. And that's really the key, is that as marketers, we've been so hyper-focused on data. And as marketers, we're not supposed to be data experts. Marketers are supposed to be creative. So let the machines do the work so that you can still be creative. I think that a lot of stress has come into the industry because a lot of folks get into advertising because they want to come up with really cool campaigns and stuff. And then they realize the world of advertising is just a bunch of spreadsheets. It doesn't have to be. You just need to leverage the technology for what it can do. And that's really the key here.
And how do we move to a place where, you know, because we don't just want to know which campaigns have worked and have actually driven traffic to our website. And we don't necessarily just want to know, okay, cool, if we spend $50,000 on SEO and we write some blog articles and we create some additional content on our website, we're gonna drive a little bit of additional traffic. I think it's broader than that. It's okay, cool, we're doing these things, but what is adding the incremental revenue? What does it do to our unit economics? What does it do when we look at, it's a combination, because marketers won't necessarily want to jettison every effort that they're taking today that doesn't have the highest ROI. They're not going to just do the highest ROI actions and then jettison everything else and say, look, if we, for example, let's say we advertise on Pinterest and it doesn't have the same ROI, for example, as a Meta ad, it doesn't necessarily mean they're going to dump Pinterest. It just means that maybe they're going after a harder to identify or harder to find or harder to access audience. And they're saying, look, sure, maybe the easiest to access audience is a Meta audience, or the easiest to access audience that is likely to convert is maybe through a Google ad. But that doesn't necessarily mean we're going to get rid of everything else we do from a marketing initiative perspective. I think it just means we want to know that, okay, cool, we're going after a Pinterest audience. We're going to have to spend more to do that. But we know that, say, for example, the LTV of that audience is higher than perhaps the Meta audience. Maybe the Meta audience or the Google audience converts quicker, or they convert sooner, or they convert at a higher rate. But we know that perhaps the audience we get from Pinterest is a stickier audience. They have perhaps a higher AOV. Maybe they have a higher LTV. So there's a lot that goes into marketing spend planning. And it isn't just necessarily which audience converts at the highest rate within a 30-day window. And so I guess what you're trying to say, and I guess I'm interpreting and inferring a little bit here, but what you're saying is, look, we're not trying to tell marketers necessarily, okay, do this initiative, spend this amount, get this return within the context of a 30-day conversion window. But what we are trying to give them is enough insights to where if they're going to have to spend more on a given channel, they should at least understand why they need to spend more on that channel.
Yeah, and I think it also comes down to, if you remember the movie The Matrix, there's a lot of constructs that marketers today live within. For example, the 30-day window, or the 14-day view-through, or the 7-day view-through. These are constructs that were created by publishers based upon insertion order requirements. And I think if we pan the camera back a bit, we have to look at things to, first off, how do marketers today view things? They view the world of marketing as, I make an investment, that investment drives clicks, and those clicks lead to sales. That's a construct that Google wants you to believe, because Google Analytics, which is where 99% of marketers look at things, is all click-based. If we pan that camera back, the reality of how marketing functions is that we make investments and we buy impressions, not clicks. Those impressions drive awareness. That awareness then drives people into our store, whether it's retail or the digital store, which leads to clicks, which eventually lead to sales. So the point I'm getting to is that a lot of marketers are forgetting about the fact that this concept of a Pinterest audience versus a Meta audience, there's really no such thing. These impressions all work together. And since we don't have perfect information and we cannot look inside of human beings, we have to assume that these impressions are all hitting everybody essentially at the same time. Also, there's other impact that's going on. There's a concept called advertising ad stock, which I recommend anyone who's listening to this to go Google it. It's a great Wikipedia article that talks about the long-term lagged impact of advertising. Somebody sees an ad, they may even engage with it and they say, oh, that's cool. Not for me right today, but maybe later on. And it leaves a little message in the back of their brain. And it takes three or four other impressions before they decide to act. And then there's also synergies, how you can have display ads, which will lift other type of advertising and how everything all works together. I think the biggest problem that marketers have is it's less about removing the stuff that's not performing well and moving that money around. Yeah, that's always the plan. We always want to become more efficient in our marketing strategy. But what I keep hearing from our clients is, I can get the money, but I just need to know where to go scale. And my problem is that I'm running all of these upper funnel type tests, like buying Pinterest. I'm testing CTV. I'm testing podcast advertising. And I'm doing incrementality tests to show that it's working. But the problem is that I'm not seeing the results in Google Analytics. And in fact, most marketers, if you were to look at the results of where your sales have come from the last 90 or 180 days, you have this one bucket, which is 20 to 30%, which is things you can track. Those are like last click things. And then you have 80 to 90%, which is primarily what we call navigation, meaning organic or brand search. They just showed up. And so what we're able to do is we're able to unlock that 70 to 80% to show you how people found out about you, which is where you want to advertise. Because otherwise, if you keep focusing your dollars on that bottom of the funnel, that 20 to 30%, which is where Google wants you to be, if you're constantly putting money there, you're always going to be working against yourself. You'll never be mid to upper funnel. And as a result, your funnel will be smaller. You're going to be advertising to the same people that your competitors are advertising to. And as a result, your advertising costs are going to go up and your profit is going to start to decrease substantially. So it's important to always, if you spend a dollar today lower funnel, spend another $1.50 in the upper funnel. That money's for tomorrow and it'll start to pay off very quickly for you. That's what all of the research shows. So that's the key, is unlocking that those group of people who just show up. Where do they come from? And that what that enables you to do is it enables you to start opening up the upper funnel stuff that you keep hearing great things about. We've all read the stories on LinkedIn or Twitter about how somebody did CTV and they saw these amazing results. How come I did it and I can't see it? I saw we got more traffic to the site, but it all came in direct and I can't prove it came from CTV. And that's part of the problem today.
And how do you guys think about clickstream analytics through the lens of Provalytics? Because from my perspective as an outsider, and look, it's been a long time since I've specialized in clickstream analytics. That was very early in my career. Well, I guess I hadn't niched down yet onto more of the technical and operational consulting that I do today. And I was probably more heavily involved in the marketing side than I am in the technical and operational side of a business. But what I have seen is sure, we have this cookie apocalypse, but we also have this analytics apocalypse. And we have a situation where everybody and their dog is crying foul over Google Analytics. And even me personally, using analytics on my own websites, the reality is that Google Analytics now is basically, you almost have to be a data scientist to get much out. that's meaningful and applicable and easily actionable out of Google Analytics today. It seems to me, and look, I don't want to, you know, sound like a conspiracy theorist here, but it seems almost like Google has intentionally made Google Analytics impossible to use by the layperson because they're almost telegraphing to the world, just trust us, just run ads. We know what's best for you. We know how to allocate your spend the best. We know how to go out and find your audience the best. We know how to drive the performance of these ads the best for you. So just throw a bunch of money at us and trust us. That seems to be what Google is effectively saying. Throw a bunch of money at us and trust us because we have the best data. We have the best data scientists. We have the best ability to put your ads in front of the right people at the right time in the right situation, linking to the right page. And to me, that feels a tremendous amount of trust placed in a company that has proven that in many cases, they aren't trustworthy, that they're going to do what's in their best interest, not what is in the best interest of their shareholders, not what is in the best interest of their advertisers. When 80%+ of your revenue comes from advertising spend, you're going to do whatever is going to drive that number higher at scale. And so I think many brands, rightfully so, have massive concerns about this huge conflict of interest in the way that every single one of these ad platforms wants to take some form of attribution, and they all want to take ownership. They all want to take credit for getting the conversion. And so that's why you can see that for the exact same purchase, 3 or 4 or 5 platforms will try to take credit for that purchase. And so this is where the challenge comes in, right?
No, you're absolutely right. And I think that problem that you mentioned is not limited to Google. Meta is in the same place. Amazon is in the same place. And the truth is, they do have the world's best data scientists. They do have the best systems. But I think it was Ronald Reagan who said it best, trust but verify. These, you have to look at Google and Meta and Amazon as partners. They are partners, especially when you're spending the kind of money that a lot of our clients are spending. But you need to validate and verify, and you need to have independent verification because for a lot of our clients, they're publicly traded companies and they have a fiduciary duty on how they go about spending those dollars. So you can't trust them because, as you said, they've been proven to not be trustworthy. You could say they've made some errors, but their algorithms are focused on driving sales, guaranteed, but there's multiple routes to drive sales, and their algorithm is focused on driving sales that maximize their profits, not yours. And that's how they're built. So you need to be able to do that. Also, if you're only living in the Google universe, and for some reason or another, you have products that the only people who will buy them, all they do is they go to Google every day. They don't live in Facebook, Amazon. Now that consumer doesn't exist, but if that's all there was, you would probably do very well to just trust Google. But the minute you leave that universe, Google can't see cross platforms. Now they can with the browser, but a lot of the cross platform is now on mobile, so they can't really see it. And so you need something that can step back and pan back and see everything, because that's going to give you your best judge of what's working and what's not working. And that's the big issue. But you're absolutely right. The problem that we had many years ago in the early days of digital, which is every conversion, you have essentially 5 mothers or fathers claiming that's my baby. And it's the same situation to this day. And that's the problem most marketers have, is that if I had 100 sales today, when I log into my 5 or 6 different platforms and I add it all up, it'll say that I had 500 sales. So all marketers, we have all this little dirty little secret, is that we have some sort of methodology, some sort of back of the napkin math where we try to figure out how we attribute sales so that our reports don't make us look like an idiot when we turn it into the boss. You want to make sure that the numbers that you show in your marketing reports actually reflect reality. But the issue we run into is, how do you come up with that little bit of math? And that's the problem, is that it's become incredibly complicated. And it's now it's a mathematical problem, is really what it is, that is best suited for very fast machines to solve.
And I think one of the additional challenges that marketers have today is the omnichannel world in which they operate. So a lot of marketers today, they're pure digital marketers, meaning that they grew up in a digital marketing world. They really only understand and know digital marketing. They didn't come from the traditional marketing world. They didn't come from a world where we're going to be running billboard ads. They didn't come from a world where we're running ads in bus stops. They didn't come from a world where we're putting ads on the back of trucks as they roll down the road to advertise our products or our services. They didn't come from a world where even they didn't come from a world where now we're putting ads inside of stores. So retail networks, retail ad networks, they didn't come from this world. They came from primarily a Google, a Meta, and an Amazon ads world where I place an ad, you tell me whether somebody clicked on that ad, we can then track, okay, cool, you came to my website from clicking on that ad and you converted immediately through basically a tracking tag that says, okay, you might not even have authenticated, but we're gonna put a tag, a first party tag on you because we've paid for the right to do. And now we're gonna know, okay, did they convert in 7, 14, or 30 day window? But the challenge with that model or the challenge with that world is that what we've seen, especially during COVID, is that omnichannel brands that have both physical retail and online retail perform orders of magnitude better than pure play e-commerce brands. And we now know, despite the COVID bump, that everywhere in the world, between 70 and 80% of all retail sales are going to go through some sort of physical channel. And that's slowly changing over time. And e-commerce is up and to the right still, but certainly not on the same trajectory as it was during COVID. And we still have this challenge where marketers who have been traditionally digital marketers are increasingly having to understand what aspects of digital marketing are influencing in-store purchases. And that, for many digital marketers, is a gigantic black box, isn't it? Hey team, I have a big favor to ask you. Please pause this episode and send the link of this episode to someone you know that you think would enjoy this content. Really appreciate you spreading the word. This is how we grow. We're not a Joe Rogan. We don't have big, massive advertising budgets, but we absolutely want to grow. We want to get the learnings from all of these episodes out to as wide of an audience as possible, and we need your help to do it. Thank you, and now back to your listening.
It sure is. And the only way to solve it is, again, with math. It's a mathematical equation that you can look at to solve for it. And there's nothing new under the sun. This problem has been solved for back in many years ago. And all we have to do is bring it forward and apply to it new techniques, faster computing machines, and make sure that the output is something that's actionable that people can actually use. And that's really the key. And that's what we're able to do at Provalytics. What's interesting, though, is that the mathematical techniques that we're utilizing are not new. The basis of our algorithm was developed in the 1700s. And another part of the formula is from the late 60s. It's just that it's taken this long for the computers to get fast enough to catch up, where the output can come in hours versus taking months to compute. And that's the beautiful thing, is that somehow someone had the foresight to create formulas in the 1700s that are still being used today and driving most of the AI that we're seeing all around us these days, which is pretty amazing.
And how do you guys think of yourself in the context of competitors? I've had probably two or three other marketing analytics platform technologies on the podcast before. A lot of them will say, hey, we use some form of, we've got our own kind of proprietary models that help our customers figure out where their spend is the most efficient. So when you guys go to market and you say, hey, look, this is our secret sauce. This is the thing that differentiates us. This is our UVP. What do you lead with when you're starting to have conversation with prospective clients? What do you guys think, hey, this is actually what sets us apart? This is the thing that makes us unique in the marketplace in a sea of conversations around AI and ML now, where it seems to dominate not only the discussion landscape, but it's dominating the investment landscape, where pretty much if you've got a technology and you don't have AI in your name, you're probably not going to get funding from VCs, especially with what's happening in the investment world right now. How do you guys think of yourself in that context?
First off, I would say there are a lot of players in this space, but the reality is even after 5 years from now, 99% of all marketers will still be on Google Analytics. So I will say that the biggest competitor out there is Google Analytics. Any of the other players in this space who win a client, that's a win for me, and that's a win for anyone else in this space, because that's someone who has gotten off of, hopefully off of Google Analytics. Because remember, just signing up with someone like us or one of my competitors doesn't mean that the single source of truth changes within the organization. Because I've seen it before happen where someone has gone to use advanced analytics, it wasn't that much of a success, and then they go back to GA or GA4. That's a loss for the entire industry. But if one of my competitors wins a piece of business and they are successful in getting that person to have a new single source of truth, they will continue to refer people over to their vendor of choice, but it will get people talking and realizing that there is a new perspective in town that they should be looking at that is going to unlock the upper funnel for them. My perspective, the reason I'm in this space is that I've been here probably longer than most. I started a company called C3 Metrics back in 2008. So I've seen the growth of the digital revolution. And I left before COVID thinking I'd done everything that I could possibly do. And then all these cookie changes came about. And I said, okay, everything I've built will now no longer work. I need to come up with a solution to help all of my colleagues and friends out there. But the reality is that a win for any of my competitors is a win for our industry, because most marketers will keep doing exactly what they've been doing. I hate to say this, but there's very few change agents that are out there in the CMO space. They come in and they say they're going to make changes, but sometimes they don't have enough time and they have to pick their battles. I totally get that. But the reality is that if you want to make change in this world, you really have to get moving.
And how do you think about the industry? And I've had some other marketing leaders on the podcast before that have talked about what we could say, if we were being generous, some unscrupulous players in the market that are using fingerprint JS and they're using other, what we would consider maybe black hat type of techniques to track web users across the internet, because of course cookies are going away, and they track IP addresses and they track a whole bunch of other things that are still available across the internet that haven't gone away yet. Obviously, if people are using proxies and VPNs and things like that, then it can be harder to track people across the internet, even using its, what we would consider more covert means. How do you look at this new world of saying, perhaps, not naming names, but maybe some of our competitors are using less than a completely transparent and white hat techniques to do what they do? Do you think, hey, how do we compete in a world where there are potentially some bad actors that are doing things that maybe make their technology perform better? I don't know. Perhaps that's an option. Maybe their technology performs better, or maybe it just seems like it's performing better because they're doing some things that we, based on our, I guess, what we're trying to be completely transparent, completely open, completely honest about how we're doing what we do, and we're trying to play by the rules, which, as you say, it's shifting sands. These rules are shifting sands, but we're trying to play by the rules, and maybe to a degree, our customers could perceive that this is like fighting with one hand tied behind our back versus maybe some of these other bad actors. What do you say to that? When you go into these conversations, how does that play into kind of your pitch to your customers?
When you talk, just for those who are listening so they understand, when you're talking about fingerprint JS, what you're talking about is technology that is part of a pixel code that would be added to a customer's website or be added to the ad tag that would ride piggyback. So I would say that's old technology. Pixels are going away. Anytime you add a pixel to your website, you're at risk. You're at risk for a lot of things. The FTC has brought action against some of the telehealth companies. There's a question on even adding the metapixel to your website. Some companies have had action against them as a result of that. So there's a lot of litigation and investigation around the use of pixels. But the idea being that you can connect the dots using pixel technology, what do you do about the walled gardens? You can't add an impression pixel. So there's a lot of holes in that. And you're right about one thing, which is that with cookies going away, people are not all of a sudden jumping and saying, okay, I'm going to move to the new world, because there's a lot of vendors out there that are promising, hey, we've got great profiles that we've built together. And it's built obviously around IP addresses where they've done a nice cross device graph and they've done all these great things. And those are awesome. And what that will do is that it will extend the life of cookies for a little bit longer. But what I predict is going to happen next is once Chrome has gotten rid of the cookies, and we're just talking about third-party cookies here, at least for right now, the next thing that's going to be blocked is going to be IP addresses, because under GDPR and CCPA, an IP address is considered PII information. Most people don't recognize that, but that it is. The law and the regulations do state that. And then alongside, I think in a parallel path, the browsers will be cutting down on any type of fingerprinting technology that's out there, with Fingerprint JS being the most popular one. That's going to be a troublesome one for them, because Fingerprint JS and fingerprinting is utilized for a lot of the fraud detection. So it is, that's going to be a tough one, but they're going to be cutting down on that dramatically. And it's going to be a game of whack-a-mole, because people are going to find holes, people are going to go and monetize those holes, and then the browsers are going to clamp down on it. But I do see a day in the next couple of years where there's not going to be any IP addresses anymore. They're going to be hidden. Any type of ability to track things, because remember, if you're using Fingerprint JS, you're able to connect the dots, and that's violating the walled gardens, and that violates one of the first things you said, Jason, which is, this is not about privacy. This is about me as a company like Google or Amazon protecting my dollar. And so it's in their vested interest to cut down on that type of stuff. So anyone who's using that technology, they're not in the current space. They're using older technology that is on its way out, and it's on its way out really fast.
And how do you start to square some of the things that modern CDP technology is doing, which is trying to track behaviorally what customers do once they're on a website or once they're taking action in a physical store? If we know who they are, if they're part of our loyalty program, if we're tracking what they're doing with certain payment methods, if we're tracking if they're using our apps, so in-store apps, that is. And so we know what they're doing in store. We have a certain amount of behavioral data that's happening there. We're aggregating a lot of this information together in modern CDP technology, which is a whole, it's light years ahead of traditional. When we think of MarTech technology, CDP goes a whole new step further, and it really starts to get super granular around some of the behavioral tracking that we're doing on websites. Even before somebody authenticates and even before we necessarily know who they are, we're giving them some form of an ID so that we can merge that behavioral history together. Once they finally do authenticate at some point in the future, we can merge that all together. And then we have a much more holistic view of what customers are doing when they interact with us. We can start knowing things, for example, okay, if they shop online with us and they shop in store with us, their AOV online is this, their AOV in store is this. If they shop with multiple physical stores with us, okay, their AOV in one store is this, their AOV in this other store is this. Okay, now we need to start looking into why do they perform better in certain channels? And now all of a sudden, we're going to try to start incentivizing them to go through the channels where they perform the best and where they have the best experience with us. We're also wanting to take all of this data, and we're trying to create segments. And then off the back of that, we're trying to send these segments to our major ad channels to create lookalike audiences from, instead of just saying, hey, these are the type of people we're looking for to these ad platforms. You go and find people that match this. No, that again relies too much on trust of these platforms to go and find the right people for us. So instead, we're saying, okay, these are the people we know are fantastic customers of ours. Here, we're going to give you this list. Now go and find more like them. So CDPs are starting to fill the gap. And then when we combine modern CDP technology with modern quiz commerce technology, where we're now, instead of just collecting first-party data, we're now collecting zero-party data, where we're asking the customer, what are your preferences? What are your needs? Hey, tell us what those are. Then what we're going to do is we're going to recommend the best product fit for you, so you have a fantastic experience with our brand. So we're gonna combine this zero and first party data together in a system that's designed to be able to manage that data at the profile level. And MarTech was never designed to do that, right? Marketing automation technology was never designed to do that. not to do what CDPs, modern CDPs do. And so how does your technology play nice with this modern world of CDPs? Or do you think of yourselves as completely separate and distinct from CDP technology? Because CDPs can help brands to go and identify more customers like the best customers that they have. Sure, that's great. But that's not what you're trying to do. You're trying to say, okay, cool. You're doing these initiatives behind the scenes. This is just another digital marketing initiative. But what we're going to tell you is whether those initiatives are actually working in practice or if they're just theoretical.
That's exactly right. The today CDP is the modern CRM, if you will, the direct mail file. And it's all about segmenting that file into different segments to get what you want. And remember, the job of marketing, as I described before, you make investment. You buy impressions, it builds awareness, that drives people to your store. Once you get someone to the store, it's the store's job to sell. Most larger brands, they have a growth team whose job is to drive awareness. Then you've got conversion rate optimization teams whose job it is on those landing pages to optimize those. And then you've got a CRM team whose job it is to nurture the list. We all work together, but we all have separate functions, essentially, is what, and that's the way it is. Where people have mistakes is they think advertising and marketing's job is to sell. No, it's to build awareness, to get people into your store. It's your store's job to sell. When you think about modern day retail, and you think about, let's say, a clothing store, and you've got the window, the placement in the window, the clothing, and then you've got your salespeople whose job it is to sell. Online, it's your store, it's the placement, it's the art, it's the pictures that you have that get people to sell. And then you've got the pop-up from Klaviyo to collect the email address to get them into the CRM so that you can nurture them. And then you can find out more about them and then find out, okay, exactly not only who these people are, what part of the country do they live in, who are they like of your 10 different segment of customers, where would you put them at so that you now know what type of retargeting to send to them based upon what's worked in the past to drive more sales. And that's really the key. So marketing, fill that funnel. That's what we do. Everybody else then, if everyone does their job, the numbers are going to continue to go up to the right and profit will continue to climb, which is what we want.
Absolutely. It's what we want. And when you look out across the next 12, 18 months for you guys as a platform vendor, what are some things that you don't do today that maybe your customers are asking for, or you've identified gaps in your own technology that you say, hey, we don't do this today. We know marketers need this and we're gonna try to build this out, or we're going to try to enhance this over the next 12 to 18 months. What does your roadmap kind of look like high level?
We're doing some specialized work in the CPG space, which is pretty exciting for us. That's a fascinating space because when you think about CPG, it's historically been retail. They're playing catch up in terms of the digital space because all of a sudden overnight, you can buy pretty much every product you can online. And a lot of these products, they don't have their own little world where you can go. They've said, oh, we sell through distributors. We're not worried about having a one-to-one relationship with the customer. I think the key for any brand these days is you need to have as many relationships as you can with the customer, because it helps you to understand who is your customer, why are they buying, why do they have preference to you versus other brands, and you can keep an idea of what's happening and see trends before they kick you in the butt, if you will. That's the biggest thing. The other biggest thing for us is that there's a tendency we see on digital marketers who have only lived in this digital marketing space where they want to make changes to campaigns on a daily basis. And that, my friend, is a huge mistake, because marketing all works together. It's all very complicated. And there's these long-term effects that when you start a campaign, you need to let it work. You need to sit back and let it cook a little bit. I live up here in New Hampshire. We have this concept. We call it in marketing the motorboat effect. And the motorboat effect is, in New Hampshire, we have this big lake called Lake Winnipesaukee. And if you start on one side of the lake, as fast as you can in your motorboat, and you go all the way to the middle of the lake, and as soon as you get in the middle of the lake, you cut the engine, the motorboat is not going to stop. It's going to continue to glide and move forward. And so what ends up happening is that if you start a campaign today and tomorrow you go in and make changes, that campaign from yesterday is still having an impact. You're going to never know what's working and what's not working. So we're on this kind of mission to help teach younger marketers, instead of going in and switching the dials around because it's so easy in these platforms, sit on your hands for a week. Just give it some time and try to figure out what's working and what's not working. The other big thing in terms of a recommendation that we're giving to folks is that everyone has got this Google Sheet where they keep track of daily results. They've got how much they spent per platform, what were the total sales, how many clicks they got, and then they've got click-through rate and cost and all that stuff. Add today another column called impressions and do the work to go back historically, because your Google Sheet probably goes back 3 years, and add in impressions across the board. Because what you'll start to see is you'll start to see patterns where impressions were high for a period of time, and then all of a sudden you'll start to see clicks go up. Your click-through rate will improve without you doing much, even though it's a week or two later. And it's from those other impressions that were earlier. So you'll start to understand the relationship. So those are our big missions that we're trying to put forth for clients. For us as a platform, we're in the process right now of expanding into Databricks. We're very excited about that. We were built in SAS, which is a very popular scientific language. Databricks allows us to have more scale for our clients and process the data much faster. So we're very excited about that. That's our big initiative for the next two quarters.
Love it. Love it. And how do you guys make your money? How do you charge for your services, for your clients? You're a SaaS platform, so I'm guessing there's some kind of subscription associated with your platform. How do you guys make your money?
Yeah, it's a month-to-month subscription. Instead of doing annual contracts, which are popular in our industry, our feeling is that we should have to prove our worth every single month. And plus, we work with a lot of agencies, and agencies also work on monthly contracts. So it makes a lot of sense for folks.
So it's in your name, Provalytics. We're proving our worth every single month. What, just to give us a ballpark, how would, let's say it's a brand that's doing $20 million a year in revs today. How much would somebody like that typically, let's say they're spending 10, 15% on marketing every single month of revs. From your perspective, how would listeners, if they were trying to figure out how much they would typically spend on your platform to help allocate their marketing spend better, how would they be able to work out roughly how much they're going to need to spend to get these types of insights from your technology?
Yeah, great question. As a brand, you should always start to think about, when you think about efficiencies that you can gain with this type of technology, you can easily gain 25 to 50% efficiency, meaning same amount of money, you're going to get 25 to 50% more sales than you would normally get with it. So that's pretty substantial. Most of the larger brands, when they start to look at analytics and attribution and understanding, they start to look at their marketing budget, and they look at around 9 to 10% of that budget should be spent on understanding and comprehension of how do we actually spend? How should we actually allocate our dollars? Because that's a good investment. If you spend 10% and you're able to get back a 50% or more in some cases, then that's money well spent.
Okay, fair enough. So that gives people an indication. If they're spending somewhere between 9 and 10% of their marketing spend on insights and analysis, then they're probably in the ballpark.
That's absolutely right. And what I'll say is that, listen, this is an interesting, difficult journey that a lot of folks are going to go on over the next year, especially with all the cookie changes. There's a lot of challenges. And what I find is that a lot of marketers don't have a proper foundation to understand, why are all these changes happening? What's going on? And how do we even move forward from here? And that's what I think is going to cause a lot of folks to grasp on to some of these pseudo cookie solutions and things using fingerprint JS and stuff like that. What we did, Jason, is we created an attribution certification course at no cost. It's available on our website, or folks can go to attributioncertified.com. It'll take about an hour and a half, but it's a great course that takes you through the whole process of understanding, why are all these changes happening? And historically, how did we get here? So like things like a UTM, like most people know what a UTM is because, you know, they use it all the time in GA, but they don't understand that UTM actually stands for Urchin Tracking Module. And Urchin is a company that Google acquired that was a web analytics company. And that's where the Urchin Tracking Module came in. That was the originator of Google Analytics. and they just left it in the code. That's where UTM came from. So there's some historical tidbits in here that'll help you and some really cool water cooler conversations, if you will. But more than anything else, it's going to give you a solid foundation and there's no cost. And you get a great certificate you can share on your LinkedIn as a result as well.
Fantastic. Absolutely love it. Now, as we come down to the end of our time together, and Jeff, I really appreciate you sharing your time, your knowledge, your experience with me and my audience today. But now I love to flip the script. I love to turn the microphone over to my guests, let them ask me one question, any question they like. It could be personal or professional. Jeff Greenfield, Provalytics, what is your question for me today?
My question for you, Jason, is what is the world like in terms of e-commerce today in Mexico?
It's roughly 9% of total retail is here in Mexico. So it's interesting because I'm seeing Mexico go through a similar evolution that I saw New Zealand go through when I lived there for almost 30 years before moving to Mexico. And I saw New Zealand and continue to see New Zealand go through a similar transition where pre-COVID, New Zealand e-commerce as a percentage of retail was about 9%. Post-COVID, it ended up being around 12% of total retail. So got a pretty significant COVID bump. We're seeing that in Mexico too. It's currently sitting at around 9%. It's always in the top two fastest growing e-commerce countries in LATAM. Mexico and Brazil are always competing with each other for e-commerce growth. And they are the leaders in LATAM from an e-commerce growth perspective. There's still massive challenges in Mexico around businesses being able to easily and seamlessly import products from internationally and sell them domestically. There's a massive manufacturing sector in Mexico that they're trying to protect. They have some pretty significant tariffs on certain goods coming in from overseas. There's a lot of red tape here still. There's still a lot of bureaucracy here in Mexico. And I think that's going to have to be addressed over time. But we also have the super peso coming to the fore here, which means that the peso has been one of the top two or three performing currencies in the world over the last 12 to 18 months. And as a result of that, the reality that the living costs in Mexico have gone through the roof. The federal interest rate here is 11.25%. They're trying to get a handle on inflation here. And so there's a lot of structural challenges here in Mexico, but it's a very young, very dynamic, very hardworking country. And that's showing in the nearshoring. COVID really proved to the world that relying on China as a sole source of goods is a very dangerous proposition. And so a lot of North American companies, both inside Mexico, United States, Canada, they've done either nearshoring to Mexico from a manufacturing perspective, or they're doing multi-shoring or dual shoring. And that has caused the manufacturing sector in Mexico over the last couple of years to go absolutely bonkers. And that's pushed up the demand for the peso. And that has pushed up the cost of exports out of Mexico quite dramatically. So there's a lot of structural change happening in Mexico right now. But the overarching theme is very young working age population, very dynamic population, very fast-growing population, very friendly immigration law. So unlike other countries, which are having massive issues with very low unemployment rates and not being able to get people to do jobs because they had such controlled immigration policies, because they had challenges with building housing, et cetera, Mexico has gone another direction. They were one of the friendliest countries throughout COVID in terms of having borders open during COVID. Mexico boomed during COVID. It was one of the only countries you could easily travel to right throughout the whole of COVID. And so Mexico boomed during that time. So there's been some really, really interesting structural changes that have come to Mexico over the last couple of years. But I think if I had to sum it up, I would say that Mexico is poised for a ridiculous amount of growth over the next couple of years. And I'm here for it. It's a very exciting, dynamic country to be a part of.
That's great. Sounds like an amazing opportunity. Thank you, Jason.
Absolutely. My pleasure, my friend. And if people want to get a hold of you, I'll put links to both Provalytics and your LinkedIn profile directly in the show notes. If people want to reach out to you and find out more about your platform, your technology around becoming really attribution certified, how do they find you?
The best way is just to go to attributioncertified.com, or you can go to provalytics.com. There's a link right up there for the attribution certification.
Fantastic. Jeff, I really appreciate your time, and I can't wait to have another conversation with you again soon. Are you a B2B or D2C e-commerce merchant? Then head over to greenwoodconsulting.net to learn how we can help you scale your business.